And now on the agenda to wrap up National Conference 2018, it is my pleasure to introduce industry analyst Dan Meyer. A familiar face at HMA events, you all know Dan as writer, analyst, and managing editor of four hardwood industry trade publications, including the Weekly Hardwood Review and the Hardwood Leader, the industry's only price and market forecasting newsletter, which he launched in 2005. Dan's topic this morning is a critical one. Rapidly rising hardwood log exports are currently a top concern of U.S. hardwood sawmills and raise important questions about the future of the U.S. industry. Though there are no easy answers, Dan will highlight the trends, explore the potential impacts, and ask the tough questions about what, if anything, the industry could or should do about it. To present information on hardwood lumber market recap and outlook in light of expanding log exports, please join me in welcoming Dan Meyer.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you, Linda, for the invitation. I'm greatly relieved. I spent a lot of time worrying about the number of charts I was about to present to you, and I feel a little bit better now after Dr. Allen. It won't be that intense, and I'm not that intense because I'm not that intelligent, but we'll do our best to cover the issue here. I do want to cover a very brief recap of the hardwood lumber market. I don't want to go through it all. It's not important that we go through it all this morning. You can read that. You do read that every week. But that brief discussion will set up a larger discussion on log exports. And I want to look at industry perception. We just finished a survey, or we're finishing a survey of the sawmill industry and what they perceive about the log export situation. We'll look at the government stats. What do they say? We'll ask the question. I won't answer it for you, but we'll ask the question of what should we do about it? And then perhaps think a little bit about what if we don't do anything about it. And at the end of the day, there are no easy answers, and I won't be suggesting any, so please don't attribute any to me as you leave this room. I have not suggested and will not suggest the answer to these questions. In the way of market report, let me just do a big picture thing. Kill-dried lumber prices are strong, as somebody just asked the previous speaker. We don't see that abating anytime soon. Cherry and walnut prices are at five-year highs. Ash and white oak are quickly approaching their five-year highs. Red oak, common poplar, still have a way to go, but they're still strong. Green lumber is just as strong, however, and that's much of what I want to show this morning in the way of a market recap, which means that margins are tighter. So as good as kiln-dried lumber prices are, green lumber prices are just as good, which means we're selling a lot of lumber, perhaps not making as much money as we could. Let's go through a couple of species. These are, I've got a five-year trend here, averaged across all of the regions that we track. And this is kiln-dried four-quarter lumber in the three primary grades, upper grade, one common, two common. You can see that for all of these species, lumber prices peaked back in 2014, 2015 when we had a shortage or a perceived shortage of lumber, and prices jumped back up. The dashed line to the right here represents the crest of that peak from several years ago. So you can see where we are today in relation to where we were at its five-year peak. We're still a little shy on ash. We're not back. As much as ash prices have risen, they're not back to where they were at their peak a few years ago. However, in the last 12 months, upper grade prices are up 9%. Commons have done quite a bit better, up more than 20%. So we have seen rapid increases in kiln-dried ash prices over the last year. However, again, if we switch to a view of margins, and by margin I simply mean the difference between the kiln-dried price and the green price for the same item, you see that during that entire time that upper grade prices were rising, the margins were falling, which means that green lumber prices have risen faster than kiln-dried prices. They're both going up, but the green has gone up faster than the kiln-dried. Now, one common, and this is going to be the case for most of the species I show you, one and two common have done pretty well. The margins have actually gone up. Here's a look at red oak. All of these will be the same five-year time frame, the same setup. You can see where the prices peaked a few years ago. And you can see again here with red oak that our prices are still well below where they were at peak. They've been rising for a couple years. That's the good news. They've been steadily rising. You can see sort of a flattening out, if you will, in the rate of increase in Red Oak over the last year. Switch to a margin view. You see the commons have done better margin-wise than the upper grade prices. Now, all of them have fallen off in the last 4 to 5 months, as we've seen perhaps a little bit of softening in kiln-dried prices during the holidays, while the green prices continue to go up right through. So, again, we have some margin issues that have shown up recently in Red Oak. Here's White Oak. White Oak uppers actually peaked again after that shortage back in 2014-2015 and have come down, but now are turning back up again. You see, interestingly, with one common White Oak, we're now at our five-year peak. Okay, the uppers and the two commons still have a way to go, but we're still seeing some increases at 7%, 8% over the last year for common grade White Oak. The uppers are down from 12 months ago. Margin-wise, again, for the last 2 years, the common margins have improved. The upper grade margins have declined. That is relatively consistent, again, between the different species. All right, I won't do margins on everyone here, but here's just looking at Appalachian walnut. Again, you see about a year of price increases. All of the grades of walnut are now at or above their five-year price highs. That's good news. Bad news for uppers, again, is that the margins are sharply reduced from where they were 2 years ago. The good news is they're relatively flat. They're not declining right now. It does appear that the kiln-dried and the green are tracking up together. All right, cherry prices also on the one and better are at their five-year highs. That's good news. Two commons still a little bit short. And then I'll show you lastly poplar. Upper grade poplar is doing what it always does, stay pretty steady. Commons have grown a little bit over the last year, 6% and 3% respectively. So the take-home points, let me do one more thing. Let's look at low grade, because that's become an issue this year with the strengthening in low grade markets. And really this change has happened in the last 9 months, not the last 12 months. Crosstie prices are starting to creep up. They're up 7% on average over the last 9 months. 2 and 3 flooring oak up 10%, and pallet cancer up 16% in the last 9 months. So our outlook through summer, to the questioner's point, we think lumber prices stay firm or go up through summer, simply for the reasons that secondary manufacturing is now ramping up to serve the seasonal housing growth. Stronger low-grade markets, I just showed you cants and ties, there's a great shortage in those items, so that'll keep lumber prices high. Very strong log and lumber exports, and we really think there'll be an insignificant sawmill production increase. There just simply aren't the logs to do it. There are some better log availability in the last month or so, but they're still expensive. And then we have the ongoing labor and trucking issues that will keep production from growing. All right, so why are lumber prices so strong? Some of the same reasons. We have a stronger domestic demand. We haven't had lumber overproduction in probably 2 years now, at least for a year. We have stronger low-grade markets. We have a record lumber of exports, 2 years running. Actually, 3 out of the last 4 years have been new record levels of lumber exports. And then tight log supplies with higher prices for those logs. And part of that is weather. We've had a lot of wet weather. The first half of 2017 was wet. The fall of 2017, the spring of this year, were all wet. So weather's contributing, but really log exports is what we want to talk about, because I think log exports is the biggest contributor to why lumber prices are strong today. I could probably leave this up and walk away and we'd be done. I make charts for a living though, so you're not going to get off that easy. But this is the difference, just at a glance, that we're hearing from the industry and what they're feeling. This is lumber exports over here, 2015, 2016, 2017 to the world. Log exports, same thing to the world, those 3 years. And I've highlighted in red, I know the red doesn't show up at the back of the room, but in bold here, this is the growth in percentage in log exports versus lumber exports for these 3 years. So 18% growth in red oak lumber, that's good. But log exports grew 69%. Okay, that's what we're feeling. White oak grew 20% in lumber, 28% in logs. Ash has been growing 55, 61%. Those are log export annual growth of 50%. That's why we're feeling the impact of log exports. You can look at the same thing with China, and the numbers are even more impressive. Their red oak log exports to China grew by 100% last year. That's a big number. White oak exports, log exports to China, up 89% last year. Okay, so these are the numbers that are impacting our industry. Now, you can't judge everything on percentage because logs were a smaller number, so it's easy to get a big percentage increase, but we'll unpack this a little bit going forward. But importantly, that difference, that spread, that differentiation between the percentage increases in lumber and logs is what's really playing into here. All right, let's look at industry perceptions. Like I said, we did a survey of the sawmill industry over the last couple of weeks, and we're still getting responses in. Many of you have responded to that survey. But let's look what the industry thinks is happening. This is the concern we've been hearing really since the summer of last year when this started to accelerate. U.S. sawmills tell us they're struggling to afford logs, and they're opting to export high-quality red oak, white oak, ash, walnut, hickory, cherry logs. And these are some of the comments we got that started our thinking in this direction. One guy said, we get double the return exporting logs than if we sawed them. Another said, the numbers say that I should be exporting 90% of the logs that come into my sawmill. He doesn't because he wants to keep his employees, but the numbers suggest he should be exporting that much of his logs. And we were getting increasing reports of the Chinese buyers going directly to log yards or even bidding on timber instead of going through the traditional avenues of buying them from sawmills. A little help here, there we go. So we sent out a survey. We sent it out to over 800 contacts that we have at U.S. sawmills. We got usable returns from 52 different mills. We got another scattering of email contacts or email responses. But 52 is a big number in my world, sawmills that responded, unique sawmills. And many of the ones represented in this room, again, are responding. We asked a question, one of the questions, what's the average small end diameter of exported logs? We wanted to get a picture of what they think is being exported. It used to be veneer logs. Let's see what it is today. And if you can read on the bottom there, the majority of them said the average size of logs exported were 13 to 14 inches. The next one was 15 to 16 inches. So the majority said between 13 and 16 inches was the size of the logs being exported. We asked, what's the grade mix of exported logs? And here again, you see the majority said it was clear two or clear three size logs. It's not veneer logs anymore. It's not low grade logs. It's prime quality saw logs that are the bulk of what's being exported according to the industry. Here's a good one. We asked them, what are foreign buyers paying for logs? Now that's a big question to put one number on one species of logs because it varies on the grade and on the size. But on average, you can see the individual tick marks represent individual responses, and there's a lot of duplication in there. So there's actually more data there represented than shown in the tick marks. But on average, $2,900 is what they say on a Doyle scale that foreign buyers are paying for walnut logs. White oak, $1,440. Hard maple, $1,100. Ash, $1,000. Red oak, just under $1,000. Those are the prices that the industry says foreign buyers are paying for logs. That's actually lower than what the government says foreign buyers are paying for logs. If you look at the trade data from 2017 for the full year, and you take the volume of logs that are exported, the value of logs that are exported divided by their volume, and we make some assumptions based on converting cubic meters, which is how the data are reported, into board feet. And I use the same parameters that the industry just told me is happening, 14 inches on an average log, Doyle scale. I assumed a 37% overrun on Doyle because I found a study that's about average for that size log. The government says the value of those logs exported are much higher than our industry even said they are. And that may be because there's more veneer in there than we think there is. There could be other reasons. But nonetheless, those are big, big numbers for log prices. And then if you do that and you compare those prices to what green One Common lumber prices are, you start to see really what the problem is. There's an old timer in the industry that I know that says that this relationship should be, your log prices should be no more than half the price of green one common lumber. I don't know if that adage ever held true, but if it did, we've got that flipped upside down right now. Okay, so green one common lumber prices compared to what the industry says the log prices are is pretty alarming from this survey. We asked that question in a slightly different way and said, how much more are foreign buyers paying for logs than you can afford as a U.S. sawmill to pay? And the majority of them said somewhere in the 15 to 25% range. Okay. Quite a few of them said 30% or more. So there is a big margin perceived, reported by the industry, and what foreign buyers are able and willing to pay versus what domestic sawmills can pay. All right, we asked this question. It was kind of an open-ended question, so we got comments back. To what extent, if any, are foreign buyers outcompeting American buyers? Well, we just got the numbers for it, but here's what the comments say. This happens regularly and with increasing frequency with all species except soft maple and with all log grades from zero sides clear to veneer. Foreign markets are taking at least 30% of the logs that once went through our mill. One said the biggest problem is with walnut and ash, but it's increasing with red and white oak. Other comments, we cannot win timber bids because our competitors are buying for export. One person says the volume accelerated in 2017 and foreign buyers pay 50% more for 10-inch pallet grade logs than we can afford to pay. So the comments go on, go on, go on. And importantly, some said not at all. In other words, foreign buyers aren't out competing us. It's not a problem. So remember, the survey is not 100%. Not everybody thinks log exports are a problem. Not everybody's suffering because of log exports. So I throw that up there, even though the majority of the comments tend towards the negative. Here's the major impact. This is the one we can quantify because we asked for numbers. We asked for yes-no answers, which I can tally then. We said, what are the impacts of log exports on your company? 70% of sawmills said that log exports have decreased their overall profitability. Okay, the flip side of that is 30% say log exports have increased our profitability, and presumably that's because they're getting a better yield, better return exporting logs than they would if they saw them. 83% of mills said log exports had limited their access to logs. Okay, 77% said that situation is getting worse. 98% of the mills that responded to our survey said log exports have raised log prices, and 90% of them said that situation is getting worse. 70% said log exports have actually forced them to reduce the amount that they saw. Half of them say that's still getting worse. They're still declining in their production volume. And 62% said log exports have forced a shift in the species that they utilize. In other words, they're having to switch species because the foreign buyers are taking what they would have preferred to saw. And again, half of them say that situation is still moving. Okay, so this is the impact according to you guys, according to the industry. The next question is why? How? How is it? Why is it, if it is, why are foreign buyers paying more for logs than they could pay for the equivalent volume of lumber? Okay, and the answers here range from the completely innocent to the suggestion that the Chinese are up to no good. Some of them are innocent, simply that the Chinese or foreign buyers can't get the thicknesses and widths they want from U.S. mills, so they want the logs so they can produce it themselves. On the flip side, some say the Chinese or the foreign buyers are trying to control the raw material supplies, and then they're going to crash the log markets. They control the market to control the lumber prices. Again, here's an innocent response. Their processing costs are simply lower as a reason for this. They are doing this to assure the supply and to drive out competition, regardless of their sawmill needs or costs. This is a pretty common thread. There's a lot of thoughts out there that this is being done intentionally. They're being subsidized by their government. Here's another relatively innocent one that says that the Chinese VAT on imported lumber is 17%, but the tax on imported logs is only 11%, so financially it makes sense, at least for a 6% gain, to bring in logs. This is not a unique comment. They want to put enough U.S. sawmills out of business that they can control the market. Okay, and then this is a comment that we got. It's also echoed by some information we're getting from Mike Snow at AHEC that, in fact, Russia and some other countries have restricted their shipments of logs to China to the extent that China has now focused a lot of its buying energy on the U.S. since we're still willing to give them whatever they want. So all of those reasons are in there, and that's then the industry perception of what's going on. Let's look at what the government, our government, says is going on with log exports. This is total U.S. log hardwood log exports to the world for the last 25 years. And what's immediately startling is that our current log export volumes are lower than they were back at the beginning of the 2000s. It peaked in 2005. Okay? So what's the problem? Okay? I've had that question asked to me a lot. What's the problem? The volumes are not that big. Look at it another way, and you see over the 25 years, especially over the last 10 years, lumber exports from the U.S. have shot up exponentially, while log exports have just been kind of flat. So what's the problem? Even if you look at China, where log exports have exploded, the lumber exports to China are exponentially greater. So what's the problem? I think the problem or problems are fourfold, and we'll go through these one at a time here, but our log shipments are increasingly concentrated in one market. Our log exports of key species have exploded, especially in 2017. We've seen a shift in the quality and the value of the logs that are being exported, so volume is not the only metric here. And now we're able to show that a larger percentage of the resource mix is being shipped as logs. So if you add the lumber and the logs and count it as the resource mix, the percentage of that mix that is logs is getting bigger. Well, that didn't work so well. Yeah, you can go back to that one, back to the previous one. There's a gray bar in here that didn't show up on her laptop, but that's fine. This is China's concentration of log exports to the world. So of all the hardwood logs that we export, China's percentage has grown in 2017 to 56%. So of all the logs we export, 56% in 2017 went directly to China. 20 years ago, it was almost zero, okay? If we take Canada out of the mix, China's percentage of our total hardwood log exports is 81%. So of all the hardwood logs we don't ship to Canada, 4 out of 5 go to China. So that's the concentration aspect of this. And here you can see it over the 25-year period, where Canada used to be our dominant log market. Europe was a pretty strong market. China didn't exist. All of those have gone down, and China is now the runaway largest market for our hardwood logs. We've also seen a species shift, item number 2. And this is a really cool graph with a gray. There it is. There you see it? How'd you do that? Do it again. There it is. You see it? I don't know how that's working, but there we go. Can you see it now? That's the world total. Here's the China total. What's interesting about this is when it was at its peak back in 2005, one-third of that volume was in low-value birch and maple to Canada. Okay? A third of the volume back then was low-quality stuff to Canada. All right? Look at what happens now over the last, since that time, since 2005, the peak, 12 years later. Focus on the part of the pie from red oak here in red down to walnut. That's 4 species, red oak, white oak, ash, and walnut. Okay? Look at what it has become as a percentage of the log exports just 12 years later. Here it is in numbers. 32% of our logs back then at the peak, only 32%, was red oak, white oak, ash, and walnut. Today, it's 60%. Okay? So that's the species shift. That's why volume isn't the only metric we need to look at. All right, quality and value. Forever, China has been a higher valued log market than Canada. They just buy more expensive logs. And it may be that it's higher valued species, might be higher grades, it might be larger logs. We don't know exactly because that part is not in the data. But China, on average, has paid more for hardwood logs than Canada. So when that shift happened, when Canada was the dominant market to when China became the dominant market, the average value of our log exports has increased. And with it then, we can presume a shift to higher valued species, which I just showed, to higher grades, and potentially to larger logs. All right, and then lastly, the mix, the log mix. Now this is based on the volume of log exports shown by the government statistics, which are shown in cubic meters. I've converted them to board feet based on that same formula, Doyle, 37% overrun, 14-inch logs. You add that volume of logs to the volume of lumber to get a total mix, and then you can look at the volume of logs, and in the last 5 years for red oak, it has grown to 25%. So 25% of everything that is red oak is now leaving the country in log form. Okay, up 5%. Look at what ash has done in the last 5 years. It was 13%. Logs accounted for 13% of the mix 5 years ago. Today it's 30%. 30% of our ash resource is now leaving the country as logs. Look at walnut. It's up to 36%. So 36% of our walnut is leaving as logs. White oak and cherry, and we've not seen the percentage increases, largely because of a big spike in lumber. It has increased a little bit over the last year, but we're not seeing as big a percentage again. And cherry's actually gone down from where it was because the lumber has gone up so much. So not as big of a percentage problem in those species. All right. This is where this presentation gets difficult. Everything I've shown you so far is just facts. There's nothing controversial about it, nothing to get worked up about. It's just reality. But then we have to ask the question of so what? The industry is concerned. Our survey shows that. The government stats confirm the rapid rise in export volumes, especially of key sawmill species. It's not far-fetched then to suggest that if this continues on the same path, that this industry is going to look different in 10 years. The question becomes, what do we do? What do we do about that? And I would suggest that we have to sort of process this as a decision tree model like you would any other decision. And at the start, decide if this data suggests a concern to you, either as a company or as an industry, are log exports a concern? If they're not, then the logical end of your decision tree is to do nothing. There's nothing to do. It's not a problem. Okay? If it is a concern to you, then you have to make a decision. Are we going to do something about it? Or are we not going to do something about it? Okay? If you're going to do something about it, you can do something as a company, you can do something as a collective industry, or maybe you can do some of both. But I would suggest that this might be the hardest part of the decision about, are we going to do anything at all? Because do nothing is not necessarily the wrong answer. Okay, and there's a lot of reasons for it. Why might we do nothing about it, even if we believe log exports are a problem? Why might we elect to do nothing? We might not see it as a big problem. We might not see it as a big problem yet, therefore it's too early to do anything. Maybe we don't know what to do. Maybe we don't think the trend can be stopped. Maybe we don't think we can stop the trend. Maybe we don't think we should stop the trend. That switches it to a philosophical argument. Should we stop the trend? Maybe it's too costly in our minds to take action to do something about it. Maybe we don't agree with the do something options. We'll talk about some of those. And maybe we just resolve to the fact that this divided industry can't collectively get together to cooperate to do anything. Okay, so lots of reasons why we might do nothing. What are some of the do something options that have been proposed? I'm sure you've heard some of those this week. I know you've had some discussions at your board meeting on this. The instinctual response seems to be for an outright log export ban. That's the first thing that comes to mind. I'll show you in a minute that I think that has some potential problems. Doesn't mean you can't do it, but there are some problems that you would encounter along the way. Perhaps instead of an outright ban, you look at a temporary ban. If for nothing else, to give U.S. sawmills time to adapt. Buy yourself some time, if you will, to make some changes while your log exports are temporarily banned. Question then becomes, would they? Would they use that time to reinvent themselves, or would we just use that time and get through it and then have another crisis when the temporary ban ended? We could do a selective ban, perhaps from public lands, from federal or state lands. We could do a selective ban to specific countries. I know France, for example, I understand from, I think Mike Snow told me this, that France has now banned log exports to China. So they've selectively chosen which countries can buy our logs. We could put quotas on the exports of logs and do allowable volumes overall or by country, or make it conditional or flexible based on market conditions, much like we see with the softwood lumber agreement, where those allowable import volumes of softwood lumber from Canada vary depending on market conditions. We could do something like tariffs on export logs. Though I've been told this morning that technically tariffs are illegal on exported goods, but certainly we can find a way to perhaps some call it something else, but somehow to financially restrict log exports, because we really don't have to ban log exports. We just have to make them more expensive for the foreign buyers so that we're back on level playing field. So I don't know what that would look like. All right, so let's look at arguments on both sides of this restrictive issue. And if I slip and say bans, I don't necessarily mean ban. There's lots of ways to restrict log exports, but arguments for restricting log exports. From the sawmill's perspective, you can argue that there would be less competition for logs, therefore the log costs would come down. Okay. In exchange, there would be higher lumber export volumes. If we're not shipping as many logs as I showed you to China, well, China needs wood, so they're going to buy more lumber, at least in the short term. And we will see increased competitiveness in the world market, and by that, I mean we can sell our lumber for less if we can get our logs for less, so our lumber becomes more competitive. From the secondary U.S. manufacturer's perspective, increased lumber availability. Right now, lumber is tight. Green lumber is very tight. So if we were to ban log exports, they should see an increase in availability of lumber. That would produce lower lumber prices, and then they become more competitive on the global stage if their costs come down because their raw material costs have come down. So those are some arguments for export restrictions. Here's some more. The government already is in our business. The government already restricts private property rights. We have zoning laws. We have harvesting and environmental regulations. We have the Endangered Species Act rules. We have eminent domain. We have lots of places where the government infringes upon our property rights. So the property rights issue by itself is not new, and it wouldn't be the first time the government got involved in stepping on some of those. And it may be necessary that some sort of restriction is required to achieve fair trade. Even if it doesn't feel like free trade, if China or somebody else has got unfair or unethical advantages, then maybe we need to act to rebalance the playing field to get back to fair trade. And in fact, the U.S. government already restricts log exports from federal lands of softwood logs for everything west of the 100th meridian in the United States. And that's been going on for decades. That's a line that goes from the Dakotas through Texas. Any federal log west of that line, any federal softwood log, cannot legally be exported. So the government has been involved in supporting its industries, in this case softwood, for a long time by banning log exports. So those are some more arguments for. And again, this is something that you guys have to wrestle with. If you believe this is serious enough, then really we're talking about the long-term survival of an industry. And you have to ask yourself at some level, is it more important to uphold our values, our tightly held beliefs about private property rights, for example, or to save our businesses? Where's the balance? Do we hold on to those values so tightly that we're not willing to let go of some of that to save our industry, if you believe that's how dire it will become? And then lastly, other countries, even some industrialized countries, are increasingly banning their log exports. So we wouldn't be the first country to start doing that, to start protecting its own industries. So those are some arguments for the ban. arguments against the ban, the number one that comes up is it tramples private property rights. And when you ban or when you restrict log exports, even if you put a tariff on log exports, what you've done is you've limited the revenue of the landowner. That person who's invested in that timber, who's managed it, who's taken the risks, who's paid the taxes on it, you've reduced not only the revenue potential, but you've reduced their property value. Okay? And at some level, it arbitrarily, if we ban log exports, it arbitrarily favors the manufacturers over the landowners. Because we can decide to restrict log exports, and from a sawmill, that makes perfect sense, because that's my raw material. But look at the secondary manufacturer who's buying lumber saying, if you're willing to send logs over in raw form, why are you willing to send lumber? Because that's my raw material. You know, could you keep some of that at home? Because that would help my business, right? So in a way, a log restrictive measure favors many of the guys in this room, guys and gals, but not necessarily the landowner. It's un-American. People tell you it's un-American, it's protectionist. It impinges on free trade. Restricting log exports, which lowers value, also disincentivizes forest management. If you've lowered my potential for revenue, then you've actually incentivized me to do something else with that land, put it into some other sort of development. And now with the discussion of trade wars, certainly other countries might retaliate. If we said to China that you can no longer have our logs, they may well say, well, then we don't want your lumber either. Okay, and that's not going to help the situation. Other arguments against a restrictive measure. As I see it, any benefits that we might get from restricting log exports would be short-lived. And this is my thinking. And on the log side, in the short term, yes, we see increased availability of logs and the prices drop. In the midterm, and that might be almost immediately, landowners will start pulling their timber off the market. Because landowners don't like to get lower prices for their logs than their neighbor got or than they got 5 years ago. So if we try to push log prices down too much or too rapidly, they start to pull their timber off the market. We have to turn around and start raising the prices to get them to bring the timber back onto the market. So advantage gone, at least in the long term, and that may come relatively quickly. Same thing with lumber. If we restrict log exports, we increase exports and prices of lumber. That happens immediately. In the midterm, though, our foreign buyers are looking for alternatives, and it may even be non-wood alternatives. And then we produce more lumber, we have less demand from overseas, suddenly we have to drop our prices to entice the buyers back to the market again. So the advantages go away financially in the long term. At least that's what I'm thinking. All right, so that brings us to the most difficult question of the whole issue is would restricting exports save the industry or would it just delay its decline? If the benefits are short term, if that made any sense at all, then restricting the industry may not be its solution. I don't think that an export log ban can undo or stop the global pull of manufacturing to the least cost nations. I mean, that happens in every industry. It's happening in our industry. It's happened with flooring. It's happened with furniture. It's happening with cabinets. There's no reason to believe it won't happen with sawmills. We can't ban that out of existence. To hold it here, we're going to have ongoing, continual, external controls that keep that manufacturing here. But those kind of barriers are the ones that effectively keep consumer goods prices elevated, encourage substitution, which defeat the whole purpose of the restriction in the first place. Okay, that's even harder than I can think about. I hope that made any sense at all. But I just wonder out loud whether a ban would be a permanent solution to the problem that has arisen. And if not, if we choose not to go that route as an industry, if we can't or we won't control log exports, then what becomes of a U.S. sawmill? We're already at this stage for many, many, many sawmills. And if it continues, if sawmills can't buy logs at prices at which they can profitably produce lumber, or if exporting logs remains more profitable than sawing lumber, then will we need as many sawmills in the future? What will they look like 10 years from now? Right. And then that leads into the question of what can today's mills do to continue to thrive? I mean, what can we do? If we're not going to address the log export situation directly, what do we do as an industry, as companies, to address it? And there's really only, bluntly, unfortunately, three options, as I see it. You can either renovate, innovate, similar, to survive as one of the remaining sawmills. You can choose to be one of the ones who fight to exist. You can reinvent yourself to be something different, perhaps, than what you are today, or you can hang it up, either voluntarily or because you failed to pick option A or option B. Okay, and I don't mean to suggest that we're at this point, but this is long-term thinking. We've got to start thinking about what are we going to be in the future. By renovate, I mean basically do the same thing. Make the same things, but do it more efficiently. And you guys do this all the time. This is not new. Modernize your technology, upgrade. The question becomes, can technology overcome these challenges? Can they overcome the advantages that China has, for example, if they choose to compete with us at the sawmill level? Certainly they're behind. They're behind technologically, but they'll catch up. It won't take them very long at all. And technology advances typically provide only incremental improvements. So, you know, we're talking about small improvements in efficiency, not major changes. And there's nothing radically new that I'm aware of on the horizon that you could upgrade to that would solve this problem. Innovate, this slightly more advanced thought, says let's find new ways to make the same thing, or let's make innovative wood products. Let's think differently about what we make. Instead of making rough lumber, maybe we'll make S4S components. These are some of the ideas that have been done or that are out there. Make millimeter thickness lumber. That's all the talk right now is, why do we still push 4/4, 3/4 lumber when the Chinese want millimeters? And if that survey respondent is right, that might be a step in the right direction. Give the Chinese exactly what they want. Give them a reason to not buy logs. Maybe that's a solution. Cross-laminated timbers. If we could ever get hardwoods into the building codes, that might be a really good solution. Thermally modified lumber. Other ideas are coming along, innovative wood products, but at the end of the day, at some level, you're still making wood products. You're still making what are commodities at some level, and they're subject to global competition. So the competitive challenges won't go away just because you innovate and make new products. There will be others that will come along that make the same thing. Reinvention is the next step in that thought, and this is something you typically see with corporations, but there's no reason we can't start to think like this as small hardwood businesses. And that reinvention means do something different. Make or sell something other than what you always have. Okay? It may be that you change industries entirely, or it may be that you change your position in the industry, and that's by taking your existing strengths, your people, your capital, maybe your equipment, your knowledge, okay? Take it and apply it in a different way than you're used to doing it. What might those things look like? I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to be in your shoes and have to think about what that is. But there's several paths that have been taken by other industries. The furniture path typically was to invest in and contract with Chinese companies. So maybe your solution here in reinvention is to invest or contract with Chinese sawmills and you retain the marketing function. Okay, you let them do the sawing function, you do the marketing function. That's the path that some furniture companies took. Maybe you abandon sawing altogether and you transform into something else. Maybe you become the log procurement division for a Chinese sawmill. I mean, that's way outside the box, but they need somebody to procure logs, to fumigate, to transport, to get the phyto certificates. Okay, there may be a niche for some companies to do that. You maybe just become an independent distributor of foreign-made lumber. I mean, God forbid, but if we're talking about reinvention, this is what some of our companies might look like in the future. I don't know what it looks like, but I guarantee you that tomorrow's industry's leaders are already trying to figure this out, trying to figure out what we're going to be to survive given the realities, assuming this trend continues. So, I come back to this and say, what will you do? And when I say you, it means you as a company and you as an industry. Certainly as a company, you ought to be on this spectrum somewhere all the time. Renovating, innovating, reinventing. You ought to be doing something, regardless of what you think about the log issue, you ought to be growing your company for the future. It's just good business, and I know you all do that. As an industry, this is certainly for debate. Do we do something as an industry? Can we do something as an industry? I will suggest that if log export restrictions are what you decide to do, do it now. Decide to go after it now. Don't wait 4 years, 5 years from now, because as we've heard from others, it's probably a 10-year process to even consider getting a log ban or log restriction legislation in place, if you were to get it. Okay? Don't wait 5 years to start thinking that's the path we're going to go down. If that's the path you're on, go ahead and get that started right away. And maybe there's room to do both. If restrictions are possible, if restrictions are where you want to go, get on it, okay? But I would suggest to you, don't do it unless you're going to use the time it buys you to reinvent, okay? Don't waste all that time and energy. Don't split. If you think a checkoff was contentious, imagine if we go after something like this. If we're going to spend that time and energy pursuing a log restriction, log export restriction, don't do that unless you're going to use that time as a company to reinvent or to set yourself up for whenever that point comes when that restriction doesn't benefit you and protect you anymore. All right, that's all that I've prepared. I'll take questions if we have time, Linda. Certainly from a forest health perspective, absolutely. I mean, if that's the only place you can sell the logs, absolutely, that's going to benefit forest health. My understanding of the softwood log export restriction is that, and I apologize if I misspeak, it's been a long time since I've looked at this, but not all log exports are banned. It's banned until the domestic industry gets what it needs. Okay, so we're protecting the industry, and then beyond that, you can export logs. Okay, does that make sense? And I don't know the formulas for how they do that, but they do allow for additional exporting of federal softwood logs if the domestic industry's needs have been met based on some market formulas. So, but I agree with you. If forest health is an issue and we cut off an opportunity to sell logs and incentivize forest management, which leads to forest health, yeah, then we're working backwards for forest health. A question over here.
Would restricting log exports increase lumber exports? And in doing so, would the value of logs actually go down, or would the value of lumber rise due to decreased access to logs and subsequently manufacturing in China specifically? And would those margins hence increase for manufacturers of lumber without log costs going down?
I was with you for about the first half of that question. Then Start your question again. I can hear you fine without the microphone. Just start it and then stop it. We started off. Yes, short term, at least in the short term. Instantly, it increases lumber exports because of the volume of logs that we're shipping now to China, for example. They still need lumber. Okay, they're making their own lumber. They're making their own flooring parts or whatever out of those logs. They still need that fiber. So, yes, initially, we see lumber exports shoot up. Initially, we see lumber export prices shoot up because of the new demand for it. Ultimately, though, substitution starts to look attractive from other supplying nations or other products, even non-wood products, that eventually lower the demand or lower the prices for that exported lumber. Okay. In terms of the margin question, ask me that one again.
So one of the complaints about landowners is that log prices will come down because of the fact that the Chinese aren't in the market anymore. But if lumber prices rise because of increased ability, would log prices actually go down?
In the short term, log prices go down because China is removed from the market. Absolutely. Margins go up. Lumber prices just went up, log prices just went down. But how long landowners are willing, or if they're willing to take lower prices, is the question. And my understanding of private timber landowners is they're not very willing to come down on log prices. That's been my experience when I was in extension forestry. That's my experience that sawmills tell us today, is it's very easy for lumber prices to go up and down. It's very easy for log prices to go up to track rising lumber markets. But when lumber markets come down, log prices are very slow to come down, and landowners who are mostly non-motivated, at least the private ones, by financial return, the economics of the situation doesn't bother them. So if I don't have to sell my timber and you're going to offer me half what I got last time or a third less, I'm just not going to sell till you come to your senses and pay what I need. So I think the gains that you suggest are there. I think they're short term, and then they collapse back on themselves and we're back to zero gain from the situation. Everybody hear that? He said the Chinese have a price ceiling, so any gains we see in lumber prices will have a limit. They're not unlimited. And I think he's agreeing that whatever gains we could see from a ban would be relatively short term. In the way back. A lot of great questions embedded in there, and see if I can hit one or two of them. The initial question was on growth to supply, growth to cut ratios, and unfortunately, we only have government statistics that come out every 10 years, and they come out 10 years late by the time they come out. We haven't seen the statistics since 2012, I think, were the last government statistics on growth to cut ratios. And at that time, hardwood timber was, I believe, in the eastern U.S., we were close to a 2-to-1 ratio. We're growing twice as much as we were harvesting. That's after mortality. So if you factor out natural mortality and look at net growth, we're cutting about 1.8, about half of the allowable timber that grows. If we were to cut on a sustainable level, we'd cut double what we do now. Why don't we do that? That speaks to one of your questions. Part of it is that timber's not economically available. It's one thing to be on the landscape, it's another thing to be economically available, either because it's been put into a restrictive, you know, legal class where it's not allowed to be cut, or because the landowner doesn't want to sell it because they're not motivated in ownership by financial returns, which is most of the private timberlands, according to those studies. Most of them have economic return as a relatively low priority in their ownership goals, okay? So they're not incentivized to sell. And really no amount of money you could throw at some owners is going to encourage them to cut timber. There's no measure of economic availability to compare that against our cut. We may be cutting at 100% of what's economically available. I don't know. We have no way to measure that. The price of logs suggests we're close because they're going up. They're going up and we or the Chinese are paying those higher prices. So there is a shortage, an economic shortage of hardwood logs on the market. I don't know what it takes to, I don't know if I've even addressed your question, but I don't know what it takes to get over that. I don't know what it takes to draw more timber onto the market. If money doesn't do it, and right now, you know, log prices are probably as high as they've been in a long, long time. If that's not drawing more timber onto the market, I don't have an answer for how we solve that, how we get more. Yes, sir.
Do you have an estimate for eastern hardwoods or logs exported?
How much are exported? Well, I got to get back to my slides. I had them on the slides there, but I don't have it off the top of my head. I can get my. Yeah, I showed you cubic meters. We can switch that over to board feet just by dividing by 284 or multiplying by 0.284. All of these statistics on red oak, white oak. It's almost all. It's almost all eastern, so I don't have it broken out by. All right, so log exports. It was about 2 million cubic meters last year, so if somebody's got a phone calculator and want to multiply that by 0.284, it'll tell us how many thousand board feet. I don't have it converted here. 0.284 times 2 million. So what's that, 400 million board feet, something like that, is the equivalent of hardwood log exports. I'm shooting from the hip here, but. Something like that, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
One more?
Yeah. So we didn't really address much of the potential for subsidizing manufacturers. Chinese government subsidizes manufacturers, so they're buying logs may not really be on a level playing field with U.S. manufacturers.
Well, first of all, we don't know if it's true. That's a good point, Jim. The comment is, is the Chinese government subsidizing its industry, which is allowing it to overpay for logs, in effect, to outcompete our domestic mills? And the answer is probably, well, I won't say it. It's probably yes, but Mike Snow has just, he told me he's gotten some funding to study that question with AHEC about, first of all, where are logs going when they're exported over there? We really don't have a handle on it. We think a lot of it's going into flooring manufacture. We don't really know where they go once they leave here headed for China. He's going to study that. He's going to study what, if any, subsidies are coming from the Chinese government that are making this happen. If we can find those, then we start to look at government intervention. Now, if we can't tariff log exports, if the government won't do that because that's illegal, then we have to think, you know, we've not had this situation before. We've tariffed Chinese bedroom furniture because we found that they subsidize that industry. We put tariffs on plywood imports because they subsidize. We've tariffed engineered flooring from China, but those are all imports. Now, what happens if we find out that they're subsidizing their log purchases? We don't have a mechanism for that that we typically use to slow down log exports to China or to add a tariff to it somehow, or tariff-like thing, to account for that subsidization. So I don't know what we do at that point, but it would be nice if they're able to uncover that factually, in fact, that is part of what's going on here, is that the government is involved and that it's not purely economics. They're not purely more efficient than we are. Their labor costs are not that much lower that they can afford to pay what they're paying, that maybe there's something else going on here, that they're trying to build their sawmill industry and the government's helping. That very well could be what's happening. Yes.
So the ash resource that is driving a lot of this volume is, you know, limited in its time. So another 5, 10 years, whatever that might be. What happens after the ash is exhausted? The Chinese sawmill industry is significant by that time.
I think they like ash right now. I don't think they'll have any problem switching to red oak or white oak or cherry. Or we're already seeing. We don't have statistics on hickory log because for some reason the government doesn't collect them. But hickory logs are huge right now. Cherry's exploding. White oak's exploding. It to me it doesn't matter. If it's hardwood and it's a fiber, they're going to get it. They're particularly attracted to ash right now, and I can't fully explain that, but. I don't think there will be any trouble at all with them switching to another species. It will just intensify the demand for other stuff. We're seeing them come back on poplar logs, too. They dipped, they fell away from those for a while, but they're back on poplar logs. So. One more? We're good? One in the back, and we're done. Only the question is, has Russia limited its export logs to China, and why? And I only know secondhand through what I've heard from Mike Snow at AHEC and others. Apparently, they've raised, either added a 50% export tax on logs or raised the existing log export tax by 50%. I'm not clear on which one that is, but nonetheless, they've jacked up the export tariff on logs going into China for the purpose, at least initially, at least on paper, of building their own sawmill industry. Okay, for Russia to build its own infrastructure, to build its own sawmill industry. Now, we also understand that there's a tremendous amount of illegal logs that leave Russia into China that are bypassing that. I don't know whether that's been clamped down or whether they've taken any better enforcement measures, but at least several agencies have said that a good deal of the logs that China gets from Russia are illegally harvested and moved anyway. So I'm not sure how much impact that raised tariff has had. But at least on the surface, Russia has taken some measures, apparently, to slow down the flow of logs into China. All right. One more. The question is, do we know the difference between log exports from public lands versus private lands? And the answer is there's absolutely zero data on that question. All we have from the government is total volumes by species and by value. So I don't know the size of the logs, I don't know the grade of the logs, and I don't know where they came from. Okay. Now you can go, if this is a question that you want to pursue, you can go to the individual export declaration documents And you can buy that as a service from another company like Piers, and you can see every individual transaction and see, you know, what logs, what, you know, I'm not sure even those documents would tell you what where it came from necessarily, but you can get finer detail, but it's not available publicly. All right, thank you.